Welcome to the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. We are going back in time 30 years ago, 1988, 24 hours of Daytona. A truly groundbreaking result for TWR Jaguar, the USA outfit of Tom Walkinshaw Racing, set up 4 months before the race. First time racing in North America. First time tackling this 24-hour race on the high banks of Daytona, going up against Porsche with 11 consecutive victories at this event. The Jaguars turned up, knocked the IMSA GTP establishment on its ass with its XJR9 V12 production-based engines. Just incredible sounding vehicles, also incredibly fast, super high-tech carbon tubs, which this was before that had become the norm. Downforce as well. Cats weren't the fastest on the banking. They definitely owned the infield, and anytime top speed was not 100% of the requirement, they had the edge. Vice versa, we had the Porsches. We had other models as well where they certainly had the top speed. This turned into one of the first 24-hour sprint races that we have seen become the norm at Daytona. 1988 was one of those years where, not saying that they pushed the cars to 100% on every lap, but it really did set in motion what we have today. But the result here, Jaguar, first race, first IMSA turnout, a first and third finish, breaking Porsche's streak. They were going for an even dozen. Pretty amazing result to think of. So I spoke with Tony Dow, team manager responsible, put all this together for Tom Walkinshaw in Valparaiso, Indiana, and then spoke with one of the three race-winning drivers, Martin Brundle. Also spoke with Raul Boisel, but he happened to have the world's worst phone connection in Brazil, and that wasn't usable, unfortunately. My attempts to get a hold of John Nielsen were repeatedly unsuccessful. So, we have two Englishmen, one in the UK, and Dow, who's been a part of the Supercar series for many years now, down under. Altogether, really enjoyed speaking with them. I watched this race pretty much start to finish as a kid, and granted, I guess I was 17 or 18 at the time, but just lived it, devoured it, and I love the fact that we're at this 30th anniversary where the two of them can talk about it and bring us back to that point. Last little fun note here, Martin Brundle's son Alex Brundle is competing in the race and as part of the Jackie Chan DC Racing effort, and wouldn't it be cool if young Alex could go ahead and win the race 30 years after his old man did. All right, every episode of the Marshall Pruitt Podcast is available on iTunes, on Podbean, also on our Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page, which I urge you to sign up with, and on marshallpruitt.com. All right, off we go. 1988, 24 hours of Daytona, Jaguar kicking some behind. Mr. Dow, it has been far too long since we have seen one another, but one of the things I've always loved is you have regaled me with so many awesome stories about your time in IMSA running the TWR Jaguar program. We're at the 30-year anniversary of that 1988 debut win at Daytona, so I want to celebrate that, and I figure who better to get some thoughts than the person who set up TWR USA and ran that team. So maybe tell me if you can, let's start off by, we had Bob Tullius in the Group 44 Jaguar program, North American outfit that represented the brand through 87. You guys turned up in 88 to take that over with Daytona as your first event. What was it like getting ramped up to go racing in America in January?
Wow, it's the hardest 16 weeks of my life.
Wow.
I went to England with Carl and Bernie Haas to go and see Eric Baldy at Lola. And Ian Reid had asked me to go to Brands Hatch to meet Tom Walkinshaw. Which I did, and I signed a deal there for a year, and that was the 1st of October 1987, and I rushed back to the States, handed my notice in. I found a facility in Valparaiso in Indiana which we bought. And there's even a load of stories in that. I needed a $10,000 deposit to secure the building for the next day. Otherwise, it was going to someone else. So I found a lawyer in downtown Chicago that had a branch in London, and I went down and saw the one of the head directors and convinced him to loan me $10,000 and that TWR would take $10,000 into their branch in London the next day.
Wow.
And the guy's name was Bert Ritchie, and he did. What a star. And I had the biggest pair of balls you've ever seen at that time. And we got the building. So then we had to get the building set up for a race shop. We had to hire people. We had to build cars. And we tested at Daytona. Big Spring, Texas, which had zero facilities, so that highlighted if there was anything missing in the team structure and so on. And then we did another test at Talladega before Daytona. And I have to tell you, it was like World War III. The car had just won the world championship, and Daytona spat it out. The oil system in the engine, all the oil was going up the right-hand side of the engine in the banking.
Sure.
Starving the left-hand side. And the front wheel bearings were, I want to say a production Renault. They were a nylon piece, and they kept melting. Tony Southgate was the designer, and he was very touchy about changing anything on his car. And so we had to have a long session with Tom to explain we needed some proper roller bearings, some proper bearings in the front uprights, otherwise it wasn't worth going. And so it got done, but obviously it was new spindles and bearings and so on like that. So to get the whole thing together, it was literally 16 weeks. And after the race at Daytona, Jaguar took us for dinner. I've been on my feet for 50 hours easily. And I passed out in the food at the table. It was just, it was just like someone had pulled the pin and that was it, it was over. It was pretty, you didn't even realize how special it was. That was the first 24-hour race win for TWR.
And then that followed, obviously, a few months later with another amazing result for the team and the brand at Le Mans. But yeah, I would say that this definitely set the stage for what folks internationally remember the most about Jaguar in 88.
The things that we pushed for to make the car reliable were things that meant that it got home at Le Mans.
So, if we're looking at the Daytona lineup, Jaguar is not rolling in with one car, being humble, just, debut. Y'all show up with three cars, not only a bunch of drivers, but you've got, Formula One veterans, you've got, there are some very serious, some heavy hitters in each of the cars. This was a proper effort to put together in 16 weeks with this three-car team. Tell me about, just from an assembly standpoint, as the guy managing and coordinating and bringing everything to life, what was it like rocking up to Daytona with this big show, trying to take on America's biggest endurance race as, the insurrection, effectively, coming in first time as the Raiders?
Well, I think Tom wanted to run three cars on the basis that we might get one home. I don't think he thought we could win it. And, we should have been first, second, and third, but we had There was one of the cars, I think, with Cheever and Sullivan and someone else, and that dropped a valve after about 18 hours, but I think we would have been first, second and third instead of just first and third. And that really did make Tom aware that we actually knew what we were doing, because obviously we were, everything was completely and utterly new, you know. And what was good was the, you know, the way it all the guys came together and worked. You know, I mean, even loading the truck in Valparaiso, we were like under two foot of snow, and to get trolleys and, you know, pit equipment and goodness knows what else done, it was a mega effort. The hard bit, well, actually it wasn't hard, because the drivers, I don't know what they expected. I mean, they certainly didn't expect Daytona to be harder than Le Mans, which it was. I mean, you went from freezing in the middle of the night to, you know, 20-odd degrees in the heat of the day. And so some of the peripherals, like team clothing and food and so on like that, you know, were really hard to deal with. I mean, we were blackmailed into going with the Daytona Speedway catering instead of our own, and that always turned up late and it wasn't good quality. It was, you know, but new boys on the block, that's what we had to deal with.
So let's talk a little bit about the race itself. You did have those three, I mean, as I mentioned, and some of the other folks I've spoken with about this, beautiful, beautiful XJR9s. Not only was Southgate's design beautiful, but also the liveries as well, sound, just, you know, everything, just amazing. Tell me about the race itself, though, getting in, because, you know, by that time, the Porsche 962 was the clear car to try and beat due to its reliability. You know, it won the last many in a row. There was some pretty stiff opposition there. But tell me about getting into the race, the lead car, and what ended up being the winning car with Brundle Nielsen and Boyzell. Wasn't as if you got there easily, but what do you recall from that event with the race winner?
We actually had a couple of guys from TWR in England. We got three or four guys given us, and I think they were the Renegades that they didn't want in England. But they turned out to be... And we had an electrical fuel pump problem in the middle of the night, and we lost three laps fixing an electrical short on the fuel pumps, and they did an absolutely mega job in the dark fixing the pumps, which fortunately were in the left hand side pod, and we got there. And you know, they ran, and I still got some film of Brundle and Lammers racing each other, and they were like, you know, if Tom had seen what was going on, they raced like Formula One. maybe not quite as much, but, you know, really, really hard against each other, which was a good thing. You know, I mean, it dragged us up the field. You know, the other thing that you've got to remember is, yeah, the Porsche teams have been around a long time, but in actual fact, they weren't factory pro teams. They, you know, they got help from Porsche and things like that, but the whole field got dragged up when we arrived. I mean, when we, the next race, when we went to Miami, we were gobsmacked as to how quick the Nissan was.
Yep.
And Tom thought they were cheating in some way, and I'm like, no, Tom, they our car was built for Group C racing, fuel economy, whereas their car was built to IMSA rules for performance. And, you know, it took us all year. I mean, one of the good things was it really made us knuckle down. And if you remember, at the end of the year at Del Mar. We won a huge amount of money by running, you know, we were able to run qualifying Dunlops and things like that. So, you know, there were good learning lessons involved, but, you know, we were always good in 24-hour races. If you look at the results over 88, 89, 90, 91, in that range, Daytona 24-hours, I'd say we were always the favorites.
So when I spoke with Martin Brundle, he mentioned that between the heat, or whether it was heat from the front-mounted radiator, humidity of Florida, the temperatures fluctuating up and down, you know, draining one's energy, he just recalls that there came a point where there were very few people, very few drivers, that really had a lot of stamina left, and that was among their own personal challenges in the car. What do you remember of that, of having to cycle drivers through? And, you know, Martin mentions strapping lammers in the car and not knowing that, wait a minute, you aren't part of this car.
Yeah. No, it was very much a, you know, first of all, they were driving, let's say, 9/10 the whole time. And secondly, they had driven these cars at Le Mans and other places in the heat, but they hadn't had the extremes from the middle of the night. And you've got to remember, in those days, there was only the start-finish straight was lit, so the rest of it was pitch dark, absolutely pitch dark. And so that was, you know, pretty stressful on the guys. You know, when you're threading your way through some of the GTUs and things like that, they were out there. And they were racing. It really was. So the cars, you didn't have power steering. You had pretty sticky tyres. You know, I mean, Dunlop were really good because we had different compounds for the heat of the day, getting cold and dark. You know, so we ran and we didn't run just softer tyres. We had a different compound on left front, right front, left rear, right rear. So the tyre guys were absolutely flat out the whole time. You know, it was usually about 40 minutes for a tank of fuel, maybe 45. And by the time you've recovered, got the next set of tyres that you have a puncture set up at the wall, and then you've got the next set that's going to go on ready and properly pressured, you know, it's fairly, fairly intense.
So looking back on this result, Tony, 30 years later, what comes to mind? What does it mean to you, knowing that you know, back in 1988, you and your team showed up, turned IMSA on its head, defied what everyone thought? You know, no one, I'm not saying no one expected your team to do well, but few people would have expected a brand new program to knock all of the established teams on their ass. I know you take pride in that because we've spoken about it before, but at least on this 30th anniversary, what comes to mind about your achievement, mate?
You will not believe what I'm about to tell you. In those days, you didn't have a pit lane speed limit. And the cars would come off the turn four banking and head down the pit lane, and they'd be doing about 180 miles an hour in the fast lane. And at 3 a.m, you knew you were alive because the hair stood up on the back of your neck. And if the guy did, you know, we always set up camp down where the Union 76 thing was so the drivers had something to aim for at 180 miles an hour. And that was, I would trade almost anything to go back to that now.
Wow.
You know, that was racing, not coming down the pit lane at 45 miles an hour. We raced, and that's what was amazing. That's what I remember.
Hmm. Well, as someone who watched,
I think the drivers do. You know, I mean, a great example was Brundle came in and was staying. You know, we were double stinting drivers to start with, and we put on, you know, no tire warmers in IMSA. Heavens, that's wussy. So we had a spool in, not, we didn't have a diff in it. We had a spool.
Wow.
And he spooled up the rear tyres, and it got driven on into the barrier where you turned left to go back and join the track.
Yes.
And he smashed the nose. And I had to talk him around the lap. I mean, you've never heard such a shit-scared driver as what Martin was. So I talked him around, came in, put a new nose on, and said, be careful on your way out. Well, how marginal everything was. We had a great composite guy called Iggy, Ian Goldston, and he's still doing composite work or something down near San Diego. And Iggy collected all the bits up and spent the rest of the race piecing it all back together, gluing it back together, and shaping it into another spare nose. And Tom Walkinshaw said to me, he said, hey, laddie, you've got a really good guy there. Do you see, he's tried to repair that nose as a spare. He said, that's really impressive. And I said, yes, Tom, but that is the spare. and again, that, you know, that's all the stuff that goes on behind the curtain, but that was quite an impressive, you know, that just things like that, you know, shit, it could have been a bit of a major.
Mr. Brundle, we are at a wonderful anniversary with the 24 Hours of Daytona. Having watched your victory in 1988 with Tom Walkinshaw Racing, the glorious V12-powered XJR9, we're at that 2018 year where we get to look back a couple of decades and celebrate your achievement with your teammates, young Mr. Nielsen, Mr. Boisel, in 1988. If you could, maybe let's start off talking about the transition, because the American Group 44 Jaguar outfit had represented the brand in IMSA GTP competition. For 1988, TWR came in and took over that representation, but wasn't as if it was a brand new program by any stretch of the imagination. This is one that had really become a serious powerhouse in Europe before extending its arms into America.
It did, yeah, it's 30 years ago now, which is scary. But the team, the TWR Inc., had been set up pretty close to the race in Valparaiso, Tony Dow and his gang. And Tony had to put, you know, they had to put it together very quickly. I know they used a lot of parts from, obviously, Group C, but then changed as required for the IMSA regulations, which, if I remember correctly, had a lot more downforce.
Yep.
And could run a longer-legged engine. They put it. It was a mighty close thing. I remember us testing in Talladega as well. We popped over there, which was quite interesting, and going around Talladega in a V12 Jag, and it literally all came together at the last minute, with Reedy engineering it and the gang. Pete Hodge was over there, he's now with Mercedes-Benz Formula One, but it's a really good gang, really can-do, will-do attitude, and it sort of all came together just in time for the race. and I'd made a very difficult decision, talked into it by Tom Walkinshaw, to leave Formula One, which was a really painful thing to do, as I'd spent so much of my life trying to get there, but voluntarily leave because there wasn't really any good drives around. And he said, look, I think your career will have an upturn if you go sports car racing. And he was right, because I was lucky enough to be part of the winning team at Daytona straight away, race one. I'd raced for Jaguar before in Group C in 85 and 87, but this was full time, and then became world sports car champion later that year with lots of victories. So, and another, probably one of my most enjoyable ever races was Del Mar at the end of 88, where we had an amazing race. So, but we started off on a very good footing, but we had several problems in the race. It wasn't easy pickings.
You know, one of the things, Martin, that I find, I just always love this dynamic. So by the beginning of 1988, you have raced at Monaco and Spa, and you've raced at so many world famous tracks. What's it like parachuting into Daytona, the side of the world famous Daytona 500, with a somewhat fiddly infield road course thrown in, but these big, giant, banking sections, high-speed, long runs through. I'm guessing, despite all of the tracks you'd come across, maybe Talladega even warmed you up to the idea, but I'm guessing Daytona was a little bit of a culture shock, at least in terms of the track you had to master.
Well, you've got to remember, this is back in the 80s, so Formula One tracks weren't quite as shiny back then as they are now. Although it's beginning to develop quite quickly under Bernie Ecclestone's sort of control. I'd raced around Detroit. I'd raced, by then, where else had I been in America? Dallas, the Parkland circuit there, where I managed to smash my legs up. But some places we went to were glamorous in Formula One, some were less glamorous. I don't think I cared. I don't think I even noticed at that point. I think it's the banking that caught my attention. I remember going around with Jan Lammers, and we stopped a rental car on the banking, and it was pretty, I can't remember if that was Talladega. What is Talladega? Is that 39 degrees, Talladega?
So, yeah, you're essentially ready to fall over if you stop.
Yeah, and I remember I did IROC there as well. Later on in 1990, and if I remember, Daytona's 33 degrees or thereabouts. So I'd never been round banking. That was the thing that shocked me, and that when you come up onto the banking, I think it's turn six, where you're looking at the top of the windscreen, see where you're going, and of course the Jags were fearsome cars, and Daytona's the toughest motor race I've ever done, because of the infield. It's a little bit bumpy, you've got the banking, it's hot, you've got, I think, 13 hours of darkness at least, you've got the humidity of the daytime, shifting in the Jag, you kind of got a V12 engine strapped to your shoulder like a rucksack, and everything in those, let's call them Group C cars for now, just got hot. The whole thing was a heat sink that just got hotter and hotter through the race, and I think it was compounded. If I remember, Raoul Boisel flaked a little bit in the night, physically struggled, so it was kind of Super John and me carrying it all the way nearly to the end. And there's a bit of a fun story right at the end, but they were incredibly physical cars, and it was a physical race, and so that's the thing that caught my attention. I don't think I was too fussed about the surroundings, and going racing in America's definitely got a different feel to it somewhere than Europe, more of a friendly, happy, everybody's doing very well kind of feel to it. But I remember there being a lot of cars in the race, and still 30 years later I can remember, I believe it was a Corvette, that had got "Thanks, Wendy" written on the back of it. And back then, we seemed to be, I think the quality and depth is much greater now. I'm looking forward to coming over and seeing my son race at the end of the month in the Jackie Chan Orica, because it looks like it's going to be a mighty motor race. Yeah. I think there were a few more weekend warriors back then, and maybe even once a year warriors. And so you were lapping some cars, what seemed like every two or three laps, because of the speed differential. And I don't think I'm exaggerating too much of that. And I do remember this car that I always seemed to catch in the kink or somewhere really uncomfortable with a closing speed of 100 miles an hour everywhere, that had "Thanks, Wendy" written on the back. And to this day, I wonder who Wendy was. but it was pretty challenging getting through the back markers. Elg was in the race, and he still comes up to me at Grand Prix. He's involved with Marcus Ericsson, who drives for Sauber. Because at one point, we had to make a bit of a comeback through the field because we had some electrical glitches, and I think I hit the inside of the pit wall. We can talk about that in a minute. But on one of the stops, and we've got a long way behind, we had to work the yellows hard. And I came up against some Porsches who were stuck behind a load of GT cars coming out of the final turn, what would be turn four, on the bank circuit. And so I just went flat out down onto the apron, gathered it all up. I'm sure I kicked up a big plume of dust, climbed back onto the banking, because I was such a new boy. It didn't occur to me that might not be a very smart thing to do. And passed sort of six cars all in one go, including ARLG, who still comes up to me, as I said, to this day, to say, "How did you do that? How did you get past this hole down on the apron?" But that's the kind of downforce that Jaguar had.
Tell me, Martin, a little bit about your teammates. And it was an extended team if we're looking at multiple cars, but I guess maybe more specifically it's almost a pub joke, an Englishman, a Brazilian, and a Dane go to a motor race kind of thing. You, Raul Boisel, John Nielsen, turned out to be a wonderful mixture of talent and personalities. What did you come to know, or what did you come to enjoy about this really fun trio at the time?
We all knew we had a good chance to win. I can't remember who was in the other cars. Was John Watson in one of them? Jan Lammers?
Yeah,
I know would have been in one of
Eddie
them.
Cheever, Jan, Watson, Dumfries. Yeah. I believe there was another. One with Davy Jones, Danny Sullivan. I think Jan was in the one with Jones and Sullivan. But yeah, I know there were at least three.
I should remember really, but I've had a few hits on the head since then and done a lot of laps, but. I think we knew we had even though it was a brand new team, we had a chance to win. I won a lot of races together with John Nielsen, and he was built very solidly, shall we say. So when things got tough, you could put Super John in the car and the Viking, and he could drive forever. And I always had good stamina. My lad's the same, so I could drive a long way as well. But I remember Barry talked about we got to the end. Towards the end, we were leading, and Raul was exhausted. John was even exhausted, and I got out of the car right near the very end. Jumped out, helped the other driver get in, and as we did there, and put seatbelts on, gave him a quick debrief, stepped back, shut the door, and watched as the car drove out of the pits. And then I realized it was Jan Lammers I'd just put in the car. It wasn't John Nielsen. What's Jan Lammers doing in our car? So I went to find Walkinshaw, and I was pretty depleted of all necessary items to function well in terms of fluids and minerals, and generally I was exhausted. And I had Tom was like a second father to me. He was my mentor. I wrote to him when I was 19 and asked him to give me a chance in a particular car, and he did. So I drove for Tom from 79 through to mid 90s, and we had a big shouting match, and I demands to know why he put Jan in the car. So we got it this far, we can get it to the end. And he basically said, you're exhausted. I said, I'm not exhausted. And he said, look, all right, Sonny, it's my team. I'll do exactly what I want. So I spun around and stormed off in anger, at which point I realized I was no longer going to be in the car. My race was over because we were coming towards the end of the race and we were going to win. And the adrenaline dropped and I just keeled over and was slumped up against a truck wheel at the back of the pit. Absolutely exhausted.
All glamour. And all course, glamour.
Yeah. And the first guy to come along and trip over me was Tom Walkinshaw, of course, who'd made his point that I was exhausted. So, you know, say the car, I think they ran 55 Celsius inside pretty much the whole race. Jeez. And we were, it was a three driver race, and so we were pretty exhausted. And the banking, I think, causes that, because you get that vertical G-force on the banking, not the lateral, with a Jag that's got a Venturi underneath it that you could live in. It was so big, so much downforce coming from underneath the thing, it just literally just pulled us apart inside the car. You know, the three of us, it was a good team. I remember in 87 I'd been racing with Raoul and the World Sports Car Championship as well. We won at Spa together, but say Super John, did a lot of IMSA races with Super John, and it was great. So we needed a bit of luck on the day. And then I think in 1990 we were unlucky when we had a chance to win. I've done Daytona, three times, and I've been lucky enough to finish first, second, and fourth back in 2011 with Zach. So. And Mark Blundell and Mark Patterson. So I like Daytona. It's always been good to me.
Martin, tell me a little bit about the competitors you faced. And I say that, or preface it by understanding that, like any serious motor racing driver, you're there with a mission, with your own team, focused on winning. But was there any appreciation for the fact that the IMSA GTP series, by the time you were coming over in 88, it was already a raging success. This race in particular, very much, American heroes, European heroes too, but A.J. Foyt's in the race, Allanser Jr., Al Holbert, Derek Bell, you know, current reigning champions of GTP or race winners and such. You look throughout this entry list, a full 75 cars, and I mean, it's legends and heroes. Was there any sense of appreciation for some of those that you maybe got to race with for the first time, who you might have read about as a lad or otherwise here in America?
No, without doubt. And especially when you're in the big driver briefing and you're sort of looking around. If I remember, it was kind of standing outside a truck, when we're being briefed, but you're looking around and you see the heroes that you've read about. And one thing I learned very early on, and something I drilled into my own son, is never underestimate anybody you're going to go and race against. Don't think just because you're coming from Formula One you're better than anybody else, because especially when you're moving into specialist subjects like touring car racing, GT, or something like IMSA and on the ovals and 24-hour racing, you have to go along and respect everybody, otherwise somebody's going to come up and smack you in the face and surprise you, metaphorically speaking, and beat you. So it was great to race against them all, and particularly I remember getting changed doing IROC in 1990. And just looking at the lockers as I was getting changed one day before going out and having some test laps with Dave Marcus, I think it was, Of course, the great names. The guy I had to fight hardest with was an Aussie, funny enough, Jeff Brabham in the Nissan. He was the one that gave me the hardest time in America for the sports car IMSA racing. But, it is, like with any 24-hour race, it's actually a 36-hour race anyway. By the time you've got up and done the warm-up and you get to the end, and there's a sense of satisfaction and achievement for anybody that crosses the line that finishes the race. It's hard. And there's an element of where you race from the last yellow, whenever that might be. But I think the traffic management at Daytona, probably the toughest in the world. I mean, Alonso is going to find this year, especially, I think. But the closing speed on some of the cars, it certainly was back in the 80s. That was managing the traffic and not making a mistake. And somewhere like the bus stop down the back straight, it's so easy to lose concentration, smash the car up from nowhere, from a tiny error. So it is, it's a mental and physical challenge, to say the least. And then you've got a lot of great drivers, as you say.
So let's close on this anniversary, 30 years later, of this, to me, really incredible, but also statement-making win. This was the GTP series through 1987. While there were victories from many different marks, the Porsche 962 had dominated. That car was the defending multiple champion winning vehicle in a row. If you were going to Daytona for a 24-hour race, you pretty much painted in a 962 as the winning model. Just tell me if you can, or for those who weren't fortunate to see it back then when you created this major upset, what was it like toppling this giant that nobody thought could be toppled in that Porsche 962, and maybe the stage that was set for Jaguar coming over to run the full championship afterwards? I mean, winning the big one to start off the season, that was huge.
It was, and it was a great credit to Tony Dow and his team in Valparaiso. There's no doubt about it. I'd raced against the Porsches from 85 and 87, and we knew how good they were, especially at the endurance stuff, just long-legged, lazy is not quite the right word, but they just gathered speed and were supremely reliable. We had the carbon chassis. We had a V12 engine, which had loads of torque, but obviously was quite a mass in the back of the car, strapped you back, and felt like it wanted to come over your shoulder half the time. Well, we had a lot of downforce, we had a lot of drivability, and we had a very good team. It was always good to have Tom on the pit wall because he was a racer himself, and he could think on his feet, and we had good strategy. So it was just a focused team, and I think it was the turning of the tide, wasn't it, really, how the carbon chassis Jaguar was now starting to beat the Porsches. We'd gathered enough speed and enough reliability and racecraft. So, I went on to win the World Championship that year. And Jaguar won Le Mans, and we started to win all over the world at that point. So for me, it was sort of the turning point, really, where the Jaguar started to become dominant. So in that respect, I don't think it was such a surprise. And I think we all went there knowing we had a chance to win. I think when you shut your front door, you hope that's what you're thinking anyway, and head off around the world. You're right, I guess everybody, there was, first of all, the Porsches had great teams and great drivers, and they had safety in numbers, so to beat them was pretty tough, to say the least. But it was, and I remember when I was part of the winning team at Le Mans with Price and John Nielsen, it was, we were still fighting like hell to beat the Porsches. Mm-hmm. So it wasn't like Jaguar took over the mantle and then just disappeared up the road, that's for sure.
So when you get to Daytona next week and your son Alex, who we all love, you giving him a little nudge saying, hey, got to maintain the family name. 30 years ago, your old man was standing in victory lane, son. Don't come second.
I don't think he needs that kind of motivation or pressure. He's pretty self-motivated, but I think this year's race looks potentially one of the most competitive ever Daytonas that I've certainly witnessed, in terms of the quality of the drivers and teams, the number of cars that could and should win that race is incredible. So I think I'm really looking forward to it. I think the pace is going to be relentless. They have four drivers in the cars now, but they're pretty angry, especially, well, I'm sure the DPIs are as well, in the P2 cars. they're physical and angry cars to drive. I did it with the Daytona prototypes back in 2011. They were challenging enough when you're in your 50s, but I'd love to see him win it or even podium it, because he's driving so beautifully, and you know, he's in a very good team. They're a little bit off the radar because of very famous people coming to do the race, but I think it's going to be interesting to see. I know a lot of people are parachuting in to see the race because it's got some great names and great cars, great teams. So I'm on edge, ready to come over next week. You're right.
And that was Tony Dow, followed by Martin Brundle, talking about Daytona 1988. 30-year celebration here, and as someone who watched and saw the Big Cats in person, as I mentioned before about the Group 44 Jaguar GTP cars that preceded them, that soundtrack just lives in my head. It's never going to go away, and if you were not fortunate enough to see them run, hear them run in person back in the day, or currently in a variety of vintage racing series, I would implore you to find something on the interwebs, on YouTube or something, just to hear the cars. They are, they're the best. They're the absolute best. All right, it is time here to get ready for the 2018 Rolex 24. So I'm going to go ahead and bid farewell. I'm Marshall Pruitt. This is the Marshall Pruitt Podcast. Thank you for listening.